Congresswoman Karen Bass offers a unique perspective on why can't California fix itself, the view from Washington. Before being elected to Congress in 2010 from California's 33rd Congressional District, she served as Speaker of the Assembly from 2008 to 2010, becoming the second woman and third African American to serve in that important post. Her time as Speaker was marked by the not-so-golden state's growing fiscal woes and by high-stakes budgetary negotiations with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. While we understand that she refused Arnold's offer of a cigar, the governor did sign 17 bills into law that Assemblywoman Bass sponsored. As Speaker, she fast-tracked economic stimulus legislation and infrastructure projects, as well as championed efforts to provide quality health care to Californians and expand opportunities for the state's youth. In Washington, she serves on the House Budget Committee and the Committee on Foreign Affairs. Without further ado, Congresswoman Karen Bass.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Good evening, everyone. So I was in the legislature. I was sworn in 2005, and that was a very challenging period in our nation, although, boy, we sure didn't know what was to come. Huh? 2005 looks like a very bright year compared to what it is right now, but it's certainly true that I found in the legislature, so goes California, so goes the nation. When I went to Sacramento in 2005, we were coming off of the dot-com boom and bust. But by 2006, we were at the height of another boom, and that was the real estate market, that all of us thought our housing prices were just going to keep going up and up and never drop. In the 6 years that I served in the legislature, there was only 1 year when the state didn't have a horrible deficit, just one out of those 6 years. And California, you know, has very strict term limits. So the longest you can serve is 6 years in the state assembly and 8 years in the state senate. And I'll come back to this later, but this is certainly one of the fundamental reasons why California is broken. And just think about it. 38 million people, right now the world's eighth largest economy, and you have a bunch of amateurs running the state. And I include myself in that. When I ran and was elected, I had never served in public office before. Within a few years, I'm running the state of California. Combine that with the governor. We all know what he was doing before he took office. So running the state of California, literally because of that, you have people who are not experienced. And then when you gain the experience and when you finally learn the job, that's when you're shown the door. So in the 6 years that I was there and the 1 year that we had money, I know I fought very hard to spend some of that money. And I was able to get $84 million put into the foster care system. And the foster care system, we could have a whole nother discussion about, but it's one of those systems that is the focus of my work. It's one of those areas where you can actually bring Democrats and Republicans together on. People are very committed to especially vulnerable children. So I was able to win $84 million. I was able to get the governor to agree to add $84 million to the budget. And so, again, if you think about California's boom and bust cycles, and if you think about term limits, I did what every other legislature does. If you happen to serve in a time when there's money, you want to use your time there to do something good. And from my point of view, that was investing in the foster care system. Well, 2 years later, the bottom fell out of the real estate market. And you may or may not be aware, but at one point in this last crisis, California was home to 40% of the nation's foreclosure. When I took over as Speaker, in May of 2008, our economy was in a free fall. It was really very scary because we didn't know where the bottom was going to be. And I remember at the end of 08, right around the time when, you know, Bush was leaving, Obama was getting ready to come in, and they were doing the TARP, you know. And I remember being in D.C. and meeting with a couple of the Congress members, never having any idea that I was going to be in Congress, but I was there trying to make the argument that if you're going to bail out the banks, how about bailing out the states? What about the world's eighth largest economy, the most populous state in the nation? We need some help in California. Could you please put that in the economic stimulus that that's going to pass out? And I remember visiting Congress members who were literally physically shaking. This was right after, you know, they received like the 3-page proposal for all of those billions of dollars. And people were really shaking. And I say that because we really didn't know what was happening with our economy. And in some ways, I'm not sure that we do now. It's more stable, but we're not in the free fall that we were in 08. So when I started as Speaker, the budget of California was $120 billion. When I left Sacramento, the California budget was $83 billion. $83 billion. And I know that people in this room know that because this institution was hurt by that. If you're going to cut and you're going to make cuts that deep, that affects your state, you know, across sector. And the UC system, you know, one of the jewels of California, was certainly hurt very badly by those cuts. And I'm afraid that those cuts are going to continue in the next, you know, over the next couple of years. So it's often said that legislators, especially Democrats, won't cut and Republicans won't raise taxes. Well, in 2009, we actually did both. We did pass small temporary taxes, and we had permanent, unfortunately, permanent devastating cuts. And I just have to tell you that another reason why California is broken is because of the outside forces that really pressure legislators. And let me just give you an example. When I served as Speaker, you know, the Speaker represents both Democrats and Republicans. And so, and I viewed myself as, you know, representing both my colleagues, whether I agreed with them or not. But my Republican colleagues were under so much pressure at different times, especially in 09. And in California, we have our own version of Rush Limbaugh. We have John and Ken. And John and Ken comes out of Los Angeles, but the John and Ken show literally threatens the Republican legislators. And at different points in time, I had security concerns over my Republican colleagues because they, John and Ken, if a legislator even said they were thinking about voting to raise taxes, the John and Ken show did this thing where they would put your head on a stick. And if you Google heads on a stick, you can see this, okay? Because it's an animated website where they will take your head, they'll put it on a stick, and it has a sound effects of like a smashing watermelon or something. It's really gory, and blood comes out. And that's what they did to every Republican that said they were thinking about voting for taxes. Of course, they put my head on a stick as well. And the problem is that when you have talk radio that does that, I'm not worried about the political people. I'm worried about the schizophrenics. That's what I'm worried about. And we all saw that. And I mean, I'm not saying that that's what led to Gabby Giffords being shot and all those people being killed. But it's the, I'm not saying it was a radio show that did that, but that's what scares me in this type of political environment. And when it comes to the state legislature, the John and Ken show, I believe, has a really plays a very abusive role to my Republican colleagues. So what happened that led to California having to issue IOUs, that was on my watch. During the time I was Speaker, we literally ran out of money, and we had to issue IOUs, and it was the first time in decades. In the 2 years that I was Speaker, the budget fell out of balance 5 separate times. But what happened really was kind of a perfect storm of events, because we had the structural issues that California has, and I've mentioned a couple of them, but I'll list them off in a list in a minute. But it collided with the free fall in the economy that we know was started by the crisis in the housing industry, but then, you know, impacted our state. It impacted California really first in a severe way before it kind of went across the country and then eventually around the globe. But we didn't realize at that time that we were in the beginning of a national and an international crisis. Everybody just thought California was so broken. And then a few months later, people kind of forgot about California because it was the whole country. So if I had to list off the structural problems in the state of California, fundamentally why the state is broken. One, California was only one of three states that required a two-thirds vote to pass a budget. Every other state, including the federal government, it's a majority vote to pass a budget. Now, many of us voted to change that in the last election. So now we do pass a budget here on majority vote, but it takes a two-thirds vote to raise revenue or to raise taxes. So they addressed half of the problem. Now, you're going to see that play out in the next few weeks, because the budget is out of balance again. And what my colleagues did, the speaker that followed me and the president of the state senate, what they did was they set a situation in place where if the budget falls out of balance, there's an automatic trigger of cuts, okay? Because they know that they won't be able to get the Republicans to vote for taxes again. So the only thing they can do is to solve the budget through cutting. So the cuts that happen to the UCs, there will be additional cuts to education across the board, K through the UCs. So the two-thirds vote now for revenue is one of the structural reasons why California is broken. The second is ballot initiatives. So everybody talks about, why do you legislators, you know, why can't you get your spending under control? Well, you know what? Everyone in this room participates in that spending. When you vote and vote for a ballot initiative, you don't necessarily think about the money that's attached to that ballot initiative. So for example, 20 years ago or so, when crime was really escalating, we voted in several initiatives to impact crime. Three strikes. We had a proposition that raised the sentencing for youth. Several propositions like that. When we voted for three strikes, we had to build 12 new prisons in California just because of three strikes. So voters, when they go voting for initiatives, they don't realize that they are spending money. And to make matters worse, you're requiring that the money be spent. So the other thing about our budget in the state of California, the legislators only have power over about 10% of the budget. The rest of it, we're forced to do because of ballot initiatives that have been passed. So the legislators have no power over that. So the other reason for the dysfunction is we have a tax code that's way out of date. We have a tax code that's based on, this kind of goes against what's happening here on Wall Street, but it's based on taxing the 1%. The problem is that that's very volatile. So when the 1% do well, the state does well. When the 1% doesn't do well, then we're on this roller coaster. And so one of my hot ideas when I was speaker was to form a tax commission. That's why I'm kind of laughing at the stuff that's going on in Washington right now. But so I got together with Governor Schwarzenegger, and we formed a bipartisan tax commission. And you never heard anything about it, did you? because that was very challenging. And the problem is that when the tax code was put into place in California, it was in the beginning of the last century. And so if you think about it, so much has changed in our economy. We're no longer an industrial-based economy. You know, we have the internet. There's all sorts of things that are not being taxed right now to bring in revenue into the state. Well, so you could extend taxes to services. The problem is, you name a service, and there's a lobby. And so every time, you know, that the Independent Tax Commission wanted to extend it, that lobby popped up and killed it. And so, unfortunately, it didn't go anywhere. They did come up with a proposal, but their proposal was similar kind of to, I didn't hear what, was it Romney or Perry? I think it was Perry today that came out with his flat tax. But it was something similar to that. And what that would have done, actually, is it would have raised taxes on the lower income. And so that was going to be a non-starter with the Democrats. And then it also would have raised taxes, period. So that would have been a non-starter with the Republicans. So, again, I just want to reinforce, because we're watching this play out nationally. My Republican colleagues, many of my colleagues, even though they philosophically did not believe in raising taxes, understood that we were in such dire circumstances that we needed to raise taxes. But they were never allowed to verbalize that. I was even at one point given the Profiles in Courage Award, you know, from the Kennedy family, and it was kind of funny because Carolyn Kennedy called me, and I thought my office got it wrong. So when they said Carolyn Kennedy called, I said, you know, Carolyn Kennedy who? And I wanted to know what area code she was calling from because I was sure they had made a mistake. But anyway, she told us that we were being given the Profiles in Courage Award, and it was given to the four legislative leaders for our courage to make decisions around the budget. So I go to the Kennedy Library, and there's all this security everywhere. And I said to Carolyn Kennedy, I said, wow, is this the way it is always at the library? I mean, how comes there's so much security here? She said, it's because of you guys. I said, what do you mean it's because of us? The John and Ken show followed us to Boston. And they were broadcasting from the library, and they were threatening my two Republican colleagues. It was the week before the election, and my one colleague, Mike Valines, who was running for insurance commissioner, did not win his election. He was winning. He had raised, I think he had raised $600,000. His opponent had raised $500,000. His opponent won. Now, his opponent only won for 2 weeks because, fortunately, people had been voting earlier before the show went after him. And so he eventually did win his primary when they counted all of the ballots. He lost in the general election. But I say that because, you know, what my colleagues go through is real. So sometimes people might know what the right thing is, might want to do the right thing, but what people don't realize is that they actually come under threat to not do the right thing. So the tax code is another reason for the dysfunction. And then term limits is a real reason. Term limits was one of those bright ideas that sounded good, but like I said a few minutes ago, it led to people with very little experience running. I mean, could you imagine changing the board of directors of a major corporation every few years just because? Not based on qualifications or you know, experience or performance, but just because they were only allowed to serve a number of years. What term limits has produced is a legislature where nobody is interested in being in the legislature. Everybody is lining up for their next job. So when I served as speaker, there was one time when I had, and now I'm just talking about the Democrats, I'm not talking about the Republicans, because my Republican colleague in charge of his caucus faced the same thing. I might have 20 of my guys all running for office, and half of them were running against each other, because they were assembly members running for Senate. And so if I have to put a budget together and I need people to vote, I have to remember, oh, well, John's running against David, so I got to make sure John and David vote the right way, and this person's doing this. And so you have this instability that occurs all the time. Now you have utter chaos because of redistricting, which was another bright idea to have an independent commission do redistricting. And so they did that. And so now it's created all kinds of chaos because now you have people running against each other, not just because they're terming out. You have people who were neighbors who are now drawn together in the same district, so you have people constantly fighting. Well, if you can imagine, that's no environment to come up with public policy. That's no environment. So a couple of the other reasons for the dysfunction I already mentioned. I mentioned the John and Ken show. But there is Grover Norquist, who now everybody knows who he is. So we used to talk about him a few years ago in the legislature. Nobody knew who he was, but now he's on the national stage. What Grover Norquist does is that he requires every Republican to sign a pledge to say that you will never vote for taxes. And so, and that pledge is held very dear. And if you violate that pledge, they might run somebody against you in the primary. Now we have the Tea Party that will run against you. But before the Tea Party, you know, the odds are if you did vote for taxes, it was kind of funny. When I first got to Sacramento, I met these lobbyists, and they were Republican lobbyists, and they were former members. And the way they would come up and introduce themselves to me is that they would say, oh, my name is so-and-so. I'm Republican. I used to be a member, but I voted for the budget And it was like, oh, okay, so you're no longer a member, yeah, because I got thrown out. I voted for the budget. On to Washington. So I turn out of Sacramento, and I go to Washington, and I feel right at home. Actually, people have said, well, what's it like going from Sacramento to D.C.? Well, I felt like I had a tremendous amount of experience. I felt like I went through 6 years of boot camp, and it prepared me to go to Washington. The difference is, of course, is that the Republicans are in charge, and in California, the Democrats are in charge. The Tea Party is very strong, so in my class, we have one of the largest freshman classes in history. There are 87 new members of the legislature. And out of those 87, we call ourselves the Noble Nine. There's nine Democrats. There's been a couple special elections, so we actually are 11 now. But there's nine Democrats out of the 87 in the beginning. And out of the Republicans, I would say about 60 of them are from the Tea Party. And they're having an interesting experience because some of them really kind of woke up and became congressmen, meaning that they started running against health care reform, and they really weren't raising a lot of money, and I think they really weren't really expecting to win. But then all this outside money came and dumped into their campaigns, and they won. And so a couple of them seem, you know, quite out of sorts. And that's been that's been kind of fun. You know, I have, even though I'm clearly partisan, clearly a Democrat, I work very well with my Republican colleagues, and believe that there's many times, if not most of the time, we're in disagreement with each other, but I always look for opportunities to work together. And so I started a foster care caucus in Sacramento, and I've done the same thing in Washington, D.C. And actually, interestingly, the first person who became my co-chair of that caucus is now running for president, and that's Michelle Bachmann. And it's interesting. She hasn't been around much, so I haven't seen her. But anyway, we've kicked off our caucus, and it's a very bipartisan caucus. We're introducing legislation, and we've actually gotten a couple of bills through. So what is similar about D.C. to Sacramento is the Grover Norquist pledge. And instead of John and Ken, there's Rush Limbaugh. The Tea Party threatening the overall Republican caucus. I actually have a lot of empathy for John Boehner, especially having served as Speaker. I know what it's like to have, you know, an unruly caucus. My caucus was always okay, but, you know, it takes a lot to manage all of the personalities and emotions of people, which is what the Speaker does. The Speaker in the state has more power, actually, than the Speaker in Washington, D.C. So it's much more of a dictatorship in California. It's much more democratic, actually, in D.C. But, you know, I described the policies are very similar because it's an ideological fight. So cuts, and Republicans calling for cuts, pushing for a balanced budget amendment, which I actually think is very dangerous. It's one of those things that sounds very good. Everybody wants to balance their budget. But if you read the details of the Republican balanced budget amendment, a balanced budget is just a mere part of it. The bigger piece is adding some of California's dysfunction to Washington. So why on earth would we want two-thirds votes for things? That's what we have in California, and the Republicans in D.C. are calling for that to be national policy. They want a constitutional amendment to bring California's dysfunction to the nation. And so I think that would be terrible. I used to describe the budget process as a hostage situation, and I would describe the demands from my Republican colleagues as ransoms. We would joke about that. And so you see a lot of that going on. You saw that with the debt ceiling. This was the first time in history, I think, if recent history, that the debt ceiling, and I don't know about most of you in this room, for those of you that are economists, I'm sure you were familiar with the debt ceiling. The average person in the United States never heard of the debt ceiling, okay, because it was routinely raised. This was one of the first times when the debt ceiling was attached to public policy. And that used to happen with us every year with the budget. In order to get the Republican votes, we would have to agree to changes in certain areas of policy that weren't able to pass in ordinary circumstances. So just to wrap up and to start the dialogue, in my opinion, we're at a crossroads in our nation, and we're asking some very profound questions. And in my view, those questions are, what is the role of government? What should the role of our nation's treasure be? Should there be a safety net? And if there is a safety net, who is it for how long, for what reason? We have clear choices to make in this country. We absolutely have a problem. We have a terrible deficit. But you get into an ideological battle when it comes to how to address the deficit. And unfortunately, some people believe in a very hard line. I think what our president has attempted to do is to have a balanced approach, but some folks on the Democratic side have a hard line, some folks on the Republican side have a hard line. Do you really seize a crisis to push through policy that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do? And then when you're talking about a safety net, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, should you extend unemployment insurance? These are the questions that we're facing right now. And when I go back to D.C. On Tuesday, we're within days of running out of money again. November 18th is the deadline where the continuing resolution will be out. And so we'll play this fight all over again. I don't believe the government will shut down. I do believe we'll walk right up to the deadline. Just one little last funny story. They were interviewing me on the news right before the government was going to shut down. We were within 4 hours of the government shutting down. And they said to me, well, what's going to happen? I mean, the government's going to shut down. I was like, we have plenty of time. It's 4 hours. We can come up with at least 10 deals in 4 hours. And they kind of, you know, made fun of me. But, of course, we did because I again, part of going to D.C. I feel very comfortable with because it's very much what I saw in Sacramento. In spite of all that, you know, people who take these jobs, people really do believe and are committed to our country. We have different visions about how to go about improving the quality of life for people in this country. But I've been very honored to speak with you today. I would love to engage in dialogue in the time that we have left.
Okay.